Welcome in to another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. We are recording this on Friday evening, one day after Xavier punched its ticket to the Elite Eight by knocking off Sean Miller in Arizona 73-71. Of course, Xavier will play in the Elite Eight tomorrow night, Saturday, at 6:09 against Gonzaga. And, you know, this can hopefully serve as a pregame type podcast for a lot of you that'll probably be listening to it on game day. And I'm going to start out with Dan here. We'll talk to the legend Brian Snow later in the podcast. Dan, take me through it. I imagine from the fan perspective, it had to be a pretty wild final 6 minutes or so, because Xavier really falls in that hole with about 5 minutes to go where they get down by about eight. It had to feel like the season was coming to an end, at least from my perspective. It certainly did. They make that run. They tie it up 71-71. Then they run a play with about 50 seconds left to take the lead. That ends up being the game-winning basket, but you still have to survive the final 30 seconds or whatever it was before they finished off the win. What were those final 5 or 6 minutes like for you?
I mean, it was just a complete, like, blur in a lot of ways. Like, when you think about the games earlier this season where Xavier's come back from deficits to win, the two that come to mind are the at-Creighton game and the game against Butler at Madison Square Garden. And in both of those cases, Xavier was down, like Creighton, they were down 11 points. Butler, they were down 7 or 8. And in both of those games, Xavier got back into the game over a period of time, like over a period of like 10 to 15 possessions. They kind of just glacially got their way back into the game. The thing about this Arizona run that they had, the mini run they had, so it was an 8-point game. Blewett hits the three. Allen scores the other end to make it a 7-point game. And that was like the last points that Arizona scored, I believe. But Xavier actually took it from 71-64 to 71-71 in the space of 40 seconds of game action, because you had Malk hitting a three. Then Xavier got a steal. That was the one where JP took sort of the ill-advised pull-up three from the top of the key. And then Bernard got the rebound and got held. So you get two free throws there. Then Bernard gets fouled, or then Trayvon gets fouled over the back at the other end after Arizona shot a quick shot. So it was like there wasn't even enough time for me as I'm sitting there to think, oh, man, you know, season's over. It was good to, you know, try to do those initial post-mortems while the game's still going on. It was like 1 second it felt like Xavier was done, and then you blink and the game's tied again, and it's like game on, and Xavier's got all the momentum. So that was pretty insane. You and Chad and various other outlets you've been on over the last 24 hours have talked a lot about Chris Mack's endgame strategy, but I really liked what they did. I think college coaches generally eschew the two-for-one. That's something that seems like a solely NBA phenomenon. Chris ran it perfectly by not just going straight to the basket, but running a really good set play that worked for him a couple times, and one that kind of gives you an out, because if you throw that lob to Sean and he gets doubled, he can back it out. He can dribble back up the baseline. You can restart and take the rest of the shot clock. But he finishes really tough, a really tough catch and finish if you watch that replay a couple times. And then, you know, X has got to get two stops down the stretch, and fortunately they were able to do it. So it was just it was pretty insane.
Aside from the end-of-game scenarios, you know, the Chris Mack X's and O's, is there anything that stood out to you most about that game or this run as a whole?
It felt like that Arizona in the first 4 minutes of the game had a really good rhythm going offensively. I think they got up like 10-2 at one point. But once X settled into the game and kind of lost their initial nerves, there was never a time where Arizona seemed to be in any kind of rhythm. Now, I know there was a period where Alonzo Trier was scoring. I think he scored 15 straight points for them. There was a period where Arizona made the run in the second half where they hit three straight threes. But everything Arizona did seemingly in the last 36 minutes of the game was like hero ball, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't see – it was either hero ball or it was second chances. I mean, Arizona never established any kind of offensive identity, it didn't seem to me. And that's a testament to what X did, because they really threw a lot of different looks at Arizona, and Arizona never got comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And granted, Arizona built its lead because Alonzo Trier was in that hero ball mode and got hot for a stretch there and hit a couple big threes against the zone. And at the same token, it's the reason they lost the game too at the end, and they couldn't operate and get any good looks against Xavier's defense because they were just relying on guys taking tough jump shots, basically, and never, like you said, never found a rhythm and never really found a way to solve Xavier's zone defense. And
so how does Lauri Markkanen only take 9 shots in that game? And how do they not get him the ball at all down in the last, like, 8 minutes?
Yeah, that was the big thing, is how does he not get any touches down the stretch when he's the guy that makes everyone else tougher to guard?
And, you know, in one of those two, the first of the two sort of end-of-game possessions that Arizona had with chance to tie or potentially take the lead, they go down and they get it on and they ISO on the low block, but they threw it to Rustich instead of Markkanen. Like you don't want to throw it to the lottery pick on your team. It was just, there were some weird decisions made. That also, by the way, that great wall up by Tyreke Jones on that post move, forcing him away from the basket and into short arming that hook shot that probably should have ended the game. I mean, if Sean goes down and hits his free throws, it ices it with 22 seconds left. But obviously it didn't matter in the long run.
Yeah. I don't want to, you know, ask you to pick which one of your kids is the favorite or anything. But when you think about the Elite Eight runs, 2004, 2008, now this one, can you rank those? Does anything stand out about one over the other? Is there one that was more rewarding for you as a fan than any of the others? Where does this one rank?
Well, ask me about 8:30 tomorrow. but no, I mean, if you just assume these first three wins, I would say that the 2008 team, was that the second one?
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite Xavier teams. It also just was the circumstances around, like, where I watched the tournament and who I was with was memorable. And that team also, you know, they beat Pitt and they beat West Virginia in that incredible overtime game with Do It BJ and all that stuff. So that probably is the most memorable one. The 04 team, that, you know, that was part of the, that all kind of floods together with the run, the four wins in Dayton in the A-10 tournament. I mean, that was a pretty remarkable 3 weeks. And I actually was at the St. Joseph's game when they absolutely destroyed, at the time, the number one team in the country, undefeated.
Jameer Nelson and Delonte West.
Exactly, yeah, that crew. And that Xavier team was really, really good. It's difficult to imagine in hindsight how they were in the predicament they were in that year. I mean, they had Romaine Sato, Lionel Chalmers, Anthony Miles. You know, it just had tons and tons of talent, and it's difficult to believe that they were in the situation they were in. Justin Cage, Justin Dolman as freshmen. But yeah, that team obviously was really good. But that 2008 team was a special team. I think that was Xavier's only 30-win team. This year, you know, this game tomorrow is really just a – I mean, it's hard to believe that they're in the situation they're in. But when you think about it, all you really need to do to make the Sweet 16 is get hot for 3 days. And all you need to do to make the Final Four is get hot for 10 days. And that's basically what Xavier is trying to do, I guess.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right about it. It's get hot at the right time situation. At the same time, I don't think that, like, it's that far-fetched that this team was capable of doing so, because there was talent. We knew there was talent coming into the season. It didn't end up being as much talent as we originally thought when, you know, obviously Miles didn't ever end up being a part of the team, and then you lose Edmund Sumner. But a core of Trayvon Blewett, J.P. McCura, we knew was going to be a pretty talented duo at the top, or at least we expected it to be coming into the season. So the fact that they're doing well and you know, obviously we talked about the shooting slumps and guys going through year-long shooting slumps and stuff like that. If you're going to do that, this is the right time for you to start making shots. And fortunately for Xavier, it's worked out that way. Trayvon, JP, Malcolm, Kaiser, they've all probably shot their best right now in the postseason, and they've taken turns a little bit on who's hot at and which game. But for the most part, those guys have really given the offense a boost by shooting the ball better, more like the way we expected them to throughout the season, as opposed to the way they shot when they're having the struggles. And I think there's a lot that goes into it. It's not just as simple as making or missing shots. I think a lot of the reasons they're making more shots now is because of the ball movement and the shots that they're getting. But, you know, I've talked about that on the earlier podcast and stuff, so I don't want to get too much into the X's and O's and keep repeating myself, but it really is amazing to see what this team has done, especially on the offensive end over the course of the last 6 weeks or so.
You made a point, I think, I can't remember which of your 100,000 podcast appearances it was, but about just when you talk about that ball rotation, you talk about Xavier playing with more freedom offensively. A huge part of that is that, I mean, they played 21 straight Big East games with UC in the middle of it. They played all these games against teams that are intimately familiar with every single player on their team, every single action they run. Mm-hmm. Now they're playing teams that don't know their stuff. And so all of a sudden, you know, stuff that hasn't worked in Big East play is all of a sudden wide open. You saw Xavier running a lot of those cross screen actions against Florida State, which is something that they can't do in Big East play because it's so familiar to the opponents at this point. I mean, they get away with it. They get it maybe once or twice a game. Against Florida State, they could have run it 20 straight times and the FSU defenders would have been sitting there with their thumb up their butt trying to figure out what was going on.
Christ Kamaji is still wondering what the hell his coaches were trying to tell him about that.
Yeah. Now their entire team is left for the NBA now, too. I mean, I guess that must have just been super traumatic. the other thing is, like, and then you got Arizona, where, of course, Sean, I mean, granted, Chris has changed up a lot of the fundamentally, Xavier basically runs a similar system to Arizona, don't they? I mean, I realize there are significant differences that have grown up over the last 8 years, but the fundamentals are the same. And so all of a sudden, Chris just uncorks some new wrinkles off the actions they already run, and they get all kinds of opportunities. The one thing that was really working for him last night, which you wouldn't expect against a team with 2 7-footers in the starting lineup, is the lob. They must have gone over the top, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. And then they also hit a bunch of those sort of screen and go. I don't know what the action is called, but where the screener just breaks for the glass.
Yeah, just slipping.
And sort of lob it up. It's just basically a pick and roll. But
yeah, quick.
But that seemed to work pretty frequently in that game as well. So I think a lot of it just has to do with playing with more freedom, which clearly they have. And I also think that getting into the tournament, once they got into the tournament, it's almost like the rain cloud that had been following them around for the last month dissipated. And it was like, okay, well, if we lose to Maryland, I mean, that sucks, but at least we didn't blow the whole season and miss a tournament. You know what I mean? It almost felt like they were playing with the sort of weight of the worst-case scenario. And now it's just kind of like house money. Like, let's just get out there and, you know, as Steve Spurrier would say, let's pitch and catch it a little bit. And obviously that has made a colossal difference in the way they played and the way they performed.
Well, I think there's definitely that, the whole playing with house money and no pressure on them thing. And then there's what we've talked about with these guys before. Trayvon Blewett, JP McCura, extremely confident guys. Extremely confident. And I mean, you saw JP McCura when they, if you watched the video of the bracket show at Chris Mack's house, before, when, you know, obviously it comes down to basically two teams left to be put up there. They put Maryland up first as the sixth seed, and you see JP immediately going, give me that. Like, I want them. You know, like, that's how they feel. They immediately, they saw that, and they're like, oh my God, we got a draw. Like, this is what we needed. Okay, good. We're good to go. They felt immediately, they felt like the protected seed all of a sudden when they saw that break. And that's just how I really think these guys' minds operate. And that sounded silly when they had lost 6 games in a row, and I understand that it did, and people gave me a hard time about it a little bit. But I meant it. Like, this is why I said that, because that's it. That's what it takes to turn a season like that around, is to have that type of confidence that we're still really good. Like, We just need a shot, a couple shots to go down, or we need to get a win or whatever it is. And once they got that, they got it rolling.
Oh, I hate to interrupt you, but I just want a news flash, and I think that this needs to stay on the podcast. Tyler Lewis just flopped, and the referee did not call it, and North Carolina immediately hit a three.
Well, the world is coming to an end. I better call Skinner and make sure he's still alive.
This is unbelievable. So you know what I was thinking? I was thinking about this today, Rick. Do you remember I'm sure – I don't know if you caught this or not. I think you did. But at the end of the Xavier-Villanova game in the Big East championship game, you and I were sitting relatively close to the court. You know, Xavier gets run over in the second half of that game, wasn't ever really competitive. And after the game, you know, everybody's milling around on the court. Villanova's getting the trophy. The Xavier players were kind of slowly meandering off. And I remember Rick Carter, who was on the staff at the time, pulling together the members of that recruiting class. So it was Ed, who was redshirting, McKinde London, who was redshirting, Trey, JP, Sean, and Larry Austin. And he pulled them together, and for about 3 or 4 minutes, he was in there with those guys, like, and I don't know what he was saying, and maybe the next time you see him, you can ask him if he remembers it. But it seemed like what he was doing was basically saying to this recruiting class, like, you guys have the chance to be special. You guys have the chance to be like them, like that Villanova team. And I think even with the ups and downs of this season, you've seen that this year. Because Trayvon Blewett has been absolutely spectacular. JP has eliminated, has sanded down some of the more rough edges in his game and has played as more of a distributor and a creative player for Xavier and very efficiently. And then Sean O'Mara has gone from being basically an afterthought 6 weeks ago to the guy that Chris Mack puts the ball, into whose hands Chris Mack puts the ball with the season on the line. So I just thought about that today as I was thinking about last night's game and who the key players were and how that moment kind of just crystallized how special this class had the opportunity to be. And now tomorrow they've got the opportunity to do something that no Xavier team has ever done.
Well, and that's interesting because this 2014 class was such a big deal when they came in. All right. I mean, I guess you pretty much have to say it, the most talented class in Xavier history in terms of recruiting rankings and all that type of stuff. And they were this close. I mean, this close to being one of the biggest busts. Like, the fans would have been extremely disappointed with this class if you think about the way the season could have gone after that six-game losing streak, if they somehow missed the tournament, or even if they're just a one-and-done this year in the tournament. You think about last year, and it's like, well, they brought a great season, most of their core guys would last year, but James Farr and Jalen Reynolds would get a lot of credit for that season, obviously. Remy Abel, maybe too. And these guys, when it's their turn this year, if they would have totally flopped and missed the tournament, it would have been, I mean, they would have not been looked upon very well in terms of how they stack up against Xavier recruiting classes. And you have the great possibility that Trayvon could be gone. Same thing for Edmund, potentially. This class could be broken up after this, and they would have had nothing to show for it. And now they're in the Elite Eight with a very real chance to potentially make a Final Four. And it's like, it's amazing how quickly this thing changes. And I know it is silly sometimes to just base everything off the NCAA tournament, but since that's the way this works, it's kind of fun to think about those types of things and how quickly the narrative and history with a program can change.
And you know, it isn't fair that that's the way it's done, that's the way that, like, players and teams and so forth are remembered. But, you know, I mean, the same is true, but that's true in every sport. I mean, right. Nobody gives a damn about Steve Stricker, but the dude is, like, one of the 10 all-time winning money winners on the PGA Tour or something crazy like that, but he's never competed in a major. People remember guys like, I don't know, Nick Faldo or Rory McIlroy or some of these other guys that collected major championships that always competed. That's just the way it is. I mean, sports is often about not just what you do, but when you do it. You know, those Butler teams that made it all the way to the national championship game, they came through consistently and when it counted. And nobody really nobody cares now that, like, both of those teams should have gone out early in the tournament. I mean, Butler had a miracle tip in to beat Old Dominion in the first round one of those years. They had a ridiculous play where a Pitt guy fouled Matt Howard 60 feet from the goal for no apparent reason that allowed Butler to win another game. I mean, it matters. It matters what you do in these clutch moments. And, I mean, it obviously has changed completely the narrative from this season, because now nobody is going to remember this season for the six-game losing streak. They're going to remember it for the NCAA tournament run.
Not that I'm breaking any new ground here, but another thought that I was just kind of actually playing out in my mind today that's along those same lines, and I know you can't just throw this out there because things might not have broken the way they did. They might not have figured out things offensively the way they did if Edmund is still a part of this team. But you look at what happened, and guys start making shots, and they start sharing the ball better, and JP makes some adjustments, and it really helps out the offense. Could you imagine now if you get this offense playing like that and you are able to fit Edmund back in, like if he actually was a major piece of this offense and it was still playing well, playing at the same level, but you had him on the court? I mean, that's to take away nothing to what Quentin Gooden's done, because his ball movement has been a really important part of what's going on, I think. But at the same time, he's not Edmund Sumner yet. And the type of threat that Edmund Sumner is, the type of athlete, you know, I mean, he's very close athletically, but just adding another 6'6 long athlete to the mix in that backcourt, if they did have him, it's like, could you imagine what people would be thinking heading into that game against Gonzaga tomorrow?
Well, first of all, I mean, Xavier would not have had the issues that it had defensively in the second half of the season if they had Edmund Sumner.
Right.
I mean, you had that guy. You had basically a giant tarantula, you know, with a 7-foot wingspan. And
but then do they find out the 2-3 zone though if that happens? You know, and
that's
is it so
question.
Effective?
They probably don't. They probably they probably stay with Chris Mack's preferred man-to-man. They probably play man-to-man pack line 90% of the time, like probably they intended to do coming into the season. But that 2-3 zone, it's gotten to a point. You know, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who went to law school at Arizona. He's a Kansas fan, but he went to law school at Arizona. And he was just talking about how, like, the last 4 minutes of that game defensively, or the last two and a half minutes of that game, it was just a defensive clinic. I mean, Arizona could not get an open look. They couldn't. Everything was harassed. They were completely off kilter. And I think what it comes down to, Rick, is something we talked about a lot with the 1-3-1 last year, which is just that Xavier's zone defense, it's not so much about being up in guys' faces. It's that it makes guys flinch because they don't know where the pressure is coming from. And sometimes the pressure is coming from their back and like their like rear diagonal, or, you know, a guy all of a sudden randomly comes in and swipes at the ball who's supposed to be on the other side of the zone. A lot of it is just complete unpredictability. And I think that's what really sustained them. You don't know how things would have developed with Edmund Sumner. I think probably the likelihood is that if Ed had been healthy all season, Xavier wouldn't have been in the situation they were in, mm-hmm. you know, hanging on to an NCAA bid by their fingernails. But would they have found this weird alchemy going into the NCAA tournament where all of a sudden they just click? Maybe. And if they had, you can certainly imagine a situation where Xavier is like a 4 seed, and all of a sudden they click going into the tournament, and it's, you know, look out. But maybe the matchups wouldn't have worked. Maybe they end up playing Kansas in the Sweet 16, or they end up playing, a team they really don't match up with because of athletes or because of something else. Maybe they don't end up in the favorable bracket they had. So, I don't know. There's a lot of counterfactuals you can look at and question.
But it's interesting to start thinking about all those different scenarios and how things played out and how it could have been so much different. You know, I mean, it's a fascinating season. It's one of the most interesting seasons I've covered, without question.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. Last season was relatively predictable. Xavier was excellent, but it was relatively predictable. As you went through, Xavier was very difficult to beat at home, and when they went on the road, they held their own for the most part. They creamed all the teams that were worse than them, and they did a nice job. And if Bronson Koenig doesn't go nuts, you know, they're in this, they're at the Sweet 16. And last year, the way that bracket broke down, I mean, it would have been Notre Dame and then potentially North Carolina. That would have been tough for Xavier to get past North Carolina to get to the Final Four. But you could certainly see a situation where a couple breaks go Xavier's way last year, and they're at this stage as well. There's a lot of things snapped into place to make this happen, and it's certainly not anything that any of us would have thought even as recently as like the 1st of March. I think March 1st was the day they played Marquette on senior night. Maybe that was the 3rd, I don't remember. But 16 minutes into that game, there was a real question as to whether the Xavier team would quit. They were awful in the first half of that game. They got run off the floor of their own gym. And the second half, they showed some fight to keep it, you know, relatively respectable. But at that point, if you'd asked me what the season was going to come out as, I would have told you, well, they're probably going to Dayton, and they may be a one and done. I would never have believed that this run would take place.
All right, so they are into the Elite Eight. They have a legit chance at a Final Four. Like, they're not, this isn't a matchup that they're going to be overwhelmed by, I don't think. So it's all you can really ask for as a fan of the Musketeers. What are you confident about for this team? Like, what makes you confident about this group heading into tomorrow night's matchup against Gonzaga?
I think they are just brimming with confidence, and they're flowing in such a way. They're playing with a fluidity. They're playing with obviously with confidence. They're moving the ball. They're hitting open shots. Guys are coming off the bench and providing immediate help, whether it be, you know, I'm not necessarily coming off the bench. Some of these guys start, but role players are stepping up and producing. Tyreek Jones comes in and produces. Rasheed Gaston's minutes have been limited, but he came in against Arizona, made a couple nice post moves. Sean is playing great. Kaiser had some nice minutes last night, particularly on the defensive end. And he played great against Florida State, obviously. You know, that's what gives me the most hope going into the Gonzaga game, because Xavier feels like a team that's got the form on their side, whereas Gonzaga, when you look particularly, you know, their first-round game you can kind of throw out, but their second-round game against Northwestern, they look great in the first half. They blew their entire lead. They got very fortunate with an absolutely atrocious refereeing decision that basically got them out of jail in that game. And then against West Virginia, I mean, that was a complete rock fight. I didn't think either team played particularly well in that game. And so Gonzaga, you know, at least for the last 60 minutes of basketball, hasn't had that same level of flow that Xavier's had over really, you know, maybe 110 of the 120 minutes of this tournament so far. So that's what gives me some hope. Now, obviously, on the other side, Gonzaga is a terrific team. They're number one in KenPom. They're number one in defense, in adjusted defensive efficiency. Karnowski creates all kinds of issues from a matchup perspective. Other than the one guard, is it Goss Williams? Is that his name?
Nigel Williams Goss. Yeah.
Nigel Williams Goss. He's terrific and is a pro. But the rest of their guys, they don't really have anybody that leaps off the page at you. But they're all just very efficient, solid, know their role, don't do crazy things, and they just know how to win. And so that's so when you look at it that way, when you kind of look at Gonzaga and you know intellectually that they're better than Xavier, just on paper, and you wonder if X can keep the flow that they have, and Gonzaga can't find it, then Xavier's going to win tomorrow, I think.
Yeah.
But if Gonzaga recovers their form, and although they got most of their wins feasting on a bad conference, they played some solid teams in non-conference and won. So I don't know. I mean, if I was in Vegas, I would definitely take Xavier in the points. I don't think it's going to be a blowout. I don't think it's going to be, you know, more than maybe a two possession game either way. But yeah, I mean, I'm not hugely confident that Xavier will win, but I think they have a realistic chance. It's not like the UCLA game in 2008 where, I mean, I just looked at the roster for the other team and said, yeah, good season, guys. We'll see you in November.
Obviously, I mean, it's easy to look at Gonzaga and understand why you'd be concerned about Xavier's chances in this game. I mean, they're a good team. And I'm going to talk to Snow here in a second. We'll get into more of the matchups and kind of break down that game. But specifically about this Xavier team, what concerns you the most heading in? Like just anything that, I mean, that you've seen that you're like, I'm concerned about that.
If they don't make threes. I mean, that's just what it's going to boil down to. They're shooting, what, 47% from threes in the tournament?
Mm-hmm. I thought Brando brought up a good point that they're basically doing what Villanova did.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice if they continued to do what Villanova did.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're a few wins shy of what Villanova did, obviously, but in terms of how they're shooting the ball so far, it's very similar to the way Villanova was playing.
I'm cool with that. Just keep it going for three more games, and, you know, maybe we can sneak Chris Jenkins on for the last shot in Phoenix and in the championship. But yeah, I mean, I that's the biggest concern is if they stop making threes. And also the other thing is I'm still not sure. And I shouldn't feel this way after the Arizona game, but I still don't know that this team is explosive enough to come back from a big deficit if they get down like 12 or 13 points in the first half against Gonzaga. If Gonzaga's hot out the gate, do they have the explosiveness to come back? I'm not sure. So those would be my two. Those would be my two concerns, which is why I think for Xavier, the first 5 minutes they need to hit some jump shots and they need to start well on the defensive end and get into a good rhythm. I don't know that they'll be able to come back. I don't know that if they start 10-2 down like they did against Arizona, they'll find it as easy to get back in the game.
Anything else that you know you want to throw out there about this game that we didn't talk about yet?
I'm concerned about the walk-on that Malcolm Bernard just absolutely leveled with a Ray Lewis style annihilation right after the last basket. I hope he's okay.
Yeah, Connor Peterson is not the thickest guy in the world. I don't know that his rib cage and bone structure could survive that kind of impact. Malcolm Bernard's backside crushing him against the hardwood on a full sprint. It was the classic bonsai drop from Yokozuna, the former WWF sumo wrestler. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
It was a brilliant move, perfectly executed by Bernard. I don't know why he thought that was a good idea, but that was fun to watch.
Well, maybe Connor can just knows how to take a bump.
Did you enjoy that or Bill Murray tossing sister's hair more after the win?
So I didn't see that until this afternoon when I watched the last bit of the game again. But yeah, that was pretty great. I mean, that's one of those things that Bill Murray gets away with that 99% of human beings don't.
One of the craziest moves I've ever seen a human do. Like, you can't just – sister's really old. Like, I don't know how old, but she's real. You can't just touch an old nun's hair like that.
That's a good way to get your finger smacked with a ruler.
Oh.
As I understand, the nuns were back in our parents' day.
Yeah. Yeah, the people forget that. All right, Dan, enjoy the game tomorrow. Really appreciate it. Good stuff, man.
Yep, and we will be back next week, win or lose, to discuss how things go. But hopefully we'll be talking about Xavier's preparations for Phoenix in the Final Four.
All right, sounds good.
Okay.
As we continue along on the podcast, we are now joined by the legend, Brian Snow. Snow, give it to me. What's your big takeaway? What's the initial thoughts after Xavier beats Arizona last night to make their third Elite Eight in school history?
That was surprising. Didn't see that one coming, Coach. I just didn't think they'd have enough at the end of the day to be able to beat Arizona, but obviously they did.
What was anything that jumped out at you in terms of, like, I mean, we've talked so much about the game plan, the defenses, the difference between, you know, Xavier switching between the defenses and Arizona having the issues with the mismatches at the four with Trayvon. What jumped out to you about the game and the way it played out?
Just how easy Xavier was able to get shots. I mean, it wasn't just Lowry. It was any time they moved without the basketball, it seemed like they could get whatever shot they wanted. And Arizona's a pretty good defensive team. So just the ease of which they were able to get good shots consistently over and over in transition, in the half court, after timeouts, that was kind of the biggest thing to me.
Chris Mack is getting a lot of credit for that, and rightfully so. I mean, because when you look at what he's done in the three games, he's really stood out, despite the fact that there's a lot of interesting storylines and impressive performances going on with the players on this team. But how much do you place, like, how important is the what the players are doing? How important is what Chris Mack is doing? Like, what do you see being the keys to the way they're getting all these easy shots?
Well, obviously, I mean, Mack deserves a ton of credit because they are executing at a high, high level. Like, it was different against Florida State. They did it, you know, they executed perfectly, but it was just different types of looks. Against Arizona, again, they executed great. I mean, they're getting open looks. So I don't know that there's one thing you can point to saying Mack's doing this, Mack's doing that. But whatever they've been drilling all year, it has come together and they are executing at a super high level.
Yeah, that's the thing that jumps out to me is just like, if you just look at one of their normal possessions, even if it's not a shot that they scored on, you know, or a possession that they scored on, you can just take a missed jumper, for instance. But you look at the way they run through their possessions, the spacing on the court, everyone seems to be moving on a string. They're all moving at the same time. Their cuts are precise. The pace is perfect. Like, the execution right now on the offensive end is just unlike anything we've seen the rest of the season from this team. And Snow, when you look at the different guys that have stepped up, I mean, Malcolm Bernard, Sean O'Mara, I think those are probably the two most surprising performances that they've gotten throughout the postseason. Is there one that surprises you more than the other between those two guys?
Yeah, I would say Malcolm Bernard, just because he's been shooting the heck out of the basketball. It's very interesting. He's done a good job, and he's been everywhere. I mean, he even rebounded. He's defended. I mean, just the contributions he's given were huge.
I got the question last night when I was doing the post-game show on Periscope about these guys being tired and Malcolm leaving it all out on the court and JP leaving it all out on the court. And I think you could go down the line and say that about just about everybody that's playing, because they're all playing so many minutes. There's really only a 7-man rotation right now. How much of a factor does that become, especially going in to the Elite Eight, where you're playing the second short turnaround in as many weeks? Do you think that's a factor at this point, or not really?
Not really. I mean, you look at most teams in the tournament are playing 7 or 8 guys. I don't think that's much of a factor at all, personally.
Yeah, I said the same thing last night. I think once you get to this point, everybody's shortened their rotation. They're all doing the same thing, and also it's kind of one of those situations where this is what you play for. Like, this is what you do all of it for. So it's a lot easier to forget about, oh, I got a cramp, or I'm tiring out, because there's no tomorrow. You know, this is kind of it. You don't have to worry about practice next week or another game next week. Just to drive home your point about Malcolm Bernard, you know, he shot 25% as a junior at Charleston Southern, shot 21% in his senior year at Florida A&M, and now in his grad transfer season at Xavier, he's shooting 40.4% on the year, and that's with over 3 attempts per game from distance. So just, I don't think anyone could have predicted that he would shoot the ball the way he has this season, particularly in the postseason when it's mattered most.
Yeah, I mean, there's no evidence to suggest this was going to happen. I mean, heck, during their losing streak, he went through a stretch where he barely could play, and now he's a key contributor at a key time, and he's been Steve Kerr from 3-point range.
Brian, what have you made of the defense? I mean, obviously they've done a good job of keeping teams off balance by switching it up, going through the man-to-man, the 2-3, the 1-3-1. Is there anything that stuck out to you about why they've been successful in switching those defenses and what they've been doing in them?
I just think they're forcing teams to make shots, and then they're getting enough of a contest that to me the perfect example is that final possession where Quentin Gooden had a good contest on a shot and it rimmed out, and they're just doing just enough to make teams uncomfortable. And obviously yesterday in the first half they didn't do a very good job on the defensive glass, but outside of that one half they've done a very good job on the defensive glass against teams. So they're in general limiting them to one shot and contesting threes and forcing teams to take a lot of threes.
When you look at Chris Mack and what he's done at Xavier, and now he can put himself in that group of coaches that have achieved Elite Eight status, you know, that's the farthest Xavier's ever been, and now he has done it along with Thad Matta and Sean Miller. Where does he rank, in your opinion, in Xavier coach history?
I mean, he certainly has the most long-term success. But, it's always tough to compare and do all that. But, I mean, certainly the best tournament coach in Xavier history. I don't think that's even remotely deniable.
So Xavier has Gonzaga in the Elite Eight Saturday night. That game, 6:09 tip-off, I believe, on TBS again. Snow, initial thoughts on Gonzaga. I think both of us agree that this is probably one of the better matchups Xavier has faced so far in the tournament in terms of how they match up personnel-wise.
Yeah, because the guards for Gonzaga, they're not going to really beat you off the bounce that well. I mean, they're slower-footed guards. And because of that, I think Xavier's going to play a lot of man because that'll put them in the best spot. And also, Gonzaga's a really good shooting team. For the first time that they faced, I mean, Arizona's a good shooting team as well, but they were more dynamic off the bounce than Gonzaga is. So I think that matchup plays well because Xavier can go man, they can get in the rebounding position, and they don't have to worry about getting blitzed off the bounce as much as they were against some other teams.
Their leading scorer is Nigel Williams-Goss, 16.5 points a game. He also averages 5.9 rebounds and 4.7 assists. He's shooting 35.3% from beyond the arc. Brian, what do you think of when you think of Nigel Williams-Goss's game?
Just steady. Just a steady dude who does a little bit of everything. Does nothing not flashy, just kind of a solid, steady competitor.
Yeah, obviously he can score himself. He's an efficient offensive player, but he also creates a lot of plays for his teammates and kind of one of the driving forces in that Gonzaga offense, whether he's scoring or assisting his teammates. Then they have Karnowski down low, who is just huge. He's a giant human, and not a lot of teams have a guy like him. What's the best way to deal with him?
I mean, to me, you just got to ball screen him, keep him moving, not let him get comfortable on the defensive end, try to make him as uncomfortable in that way as possible. Just really, you have to take advantage of the fact that he can't move. And then – I don't know. He's a really good passer, so I don't know if you want to double him, but you got to do the best you can to make him catch the ball outside of his comfort zone and then hope he misses shots. He's got a nice touch. He's a good player, and, maybe try, really get your bigs to say run the court and try to tire him out.
Yeah, and I think the other thing in terms of defending him, because where he really makes his hay is on the offensive end. He's just difficult to handle, and they can play through him. He's comfortable with the ball in his hands. He reminds me a lot of a bigger, better Matt Stainbrook, to be quite honest, because he's a guy you can throw the ball into on the post. You can play through him that way. He's also comfortable if he catches the ball away from the basket, taking a dribble or two, handing off to a guard, that type of stuff. He doesn't get flustered when he gets the ball. But because of that, because he's comfortable with the ball, he has some IQ, he has some skill, He'll also be comfortable catching the ball a little farther away from the basket than some guys will, the same issue Matt Stainbrook had at times. So I think that's one of the big keys when you're defending in the post is do your work early, force him to catch it 8-9 feet off the block, or 9 feet from the basket, and make him make his moves from a little bit farther away and hope you get him to miss some of those shots. But he's obviously going to be tough to deal with. Zach Collins, the 7-foot freshman who also played the 5 for him, is an impressive player. He really rebounds the ball well at both ends, and he can step out and face up and shoot a little bit as well. So they've got some talented big men that are going to be difficult to deal with. Snow, what really interests me about this team, though, is when you look at the wings, like what they've got from the 2 through the 4, I have to think Xavier has a pretty good advantage there.
Yeah, you know, Jordan Matthews is making shots, but he's kind of 6'2". He's a guard. You know, Xavier played – no, he played for Cal last year. It's his brother's at USC. But, you know, he's a good athlete, but he's mostly a shooter. Then let's see here. You know, Silas Melson kind of plays on the wing for him. So Jonathan Williams is more of a four. But, yeah, Xavier should have an advantage in that regard. They got more dynamic scorers and – Gonzaga's wings can't really expose Xavier so much about defensively.
Right. They're not super athletic when you're talking about Josh Perkins and Silas Melson. Guys that can knock down open jumpers for certain and certainly not inept guys. They're solid defenders. They're high IQ players. They fit well with what Gonzaga does. But they're not guys that, like, worry you and say, oh, I don't know how you match up with them. And, in fact, I think the opposite problem exists. I don't know how they match up with Xavier in certain cases, which may mean they play a little bit more zone, which they've done from time to time. Also, it's kind of interesting because they have the big man at center in Karnowski, but they also go with Jonathan Williams at the four, who's more of a post-up four, a 6'9", 228 forward. He faces up a little bit and he'll shoot on the offensive end, but he's not really the type of guy, I don't think, that you want guarding Trayvon Blewett. So they're also going to have to make some decisions defensively. If they go man-to-man, who do they put on Trayvon and how do they deal with him? That was a problem for Arizona. I think it could be a problem again in this Gonzaga game, especially with the way that Trayvon's playing right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's just dominating. So, I mean, there's really no other way to say it.
That being said, Snow, any other factors you want to throw out there that you think are going to be important? And do you want to give us a prediction on what you think is going to happen in this Xavier-Gonzaga matchup for a shot at the Final Four?
I'll pick Gonzaga by a handful. I just think, you know, they might make enough threes and that'll be a problem for Xavier. But I think Quentin Gooden and his defense on who's the point guard?
Nigel Williams-Goss.
Williams-Goss, yeah. I think Quentin Gooden's defense is going to be hugely important, or as Trump would say, bigly important, because Williams-Goss has really struggled in this tournament. He struggled with length. He struggled with athleticism, and that's what Q brings. And if he can really take Williams-Goss out of what he does, that's going to give Xavier a great shot.
Yeah, just worth noting, you know, you mentioned the three-pointers, and that's something I heard analysts bringing up a lot on TV last night. But this Gonzaga team isn't a team that relies on the three at all. You know, they're 289th in the country in terms of their point distribution, percentage of total points scored from beyond three-point range, and they're 65th in the country in terms of their three-point percentage, so solid at 37.4%, but nothing special and not even as prolific as Arizona was, which, you know, not exactly Arizona's strong suit either. So I don't think, you know, you're right. If Gonzaga comes out and gets hot from three and they're knocking down a bunch of jumpers, that's going to be a problem. But that goes for every team in the country, and I don't think they're more likely to do that than most other teams that Xavier's faced in this tournament run. So that's worth noting to me. I think Gonzaga probably wins this too. They've had a really good season. They've proven to be, you know, the people that doubted them, I think they've kind of been able to stick their nose up at those people because they've played pretty well here in the postseason in the NCAA tournament as well. But I am a little shocked at the 9-point line in Vegas. That seemed a little bit big to me. I don't know that they're going to cover that. So I like Xavier to cover the spread, but I like Gonzaga to win the game. Snow, anything else to touch on about this Xavier team reaching the Elite Eight? Anything about this matchup that you want to hit on?
Just, you know, obviously enjoy the ride. It's clearly been fun for fans, and this is why you don't panic in January.
This is true. Real quick, I just wanted to hit on with you. It's been brought up a million times. No matter how many times I shoot it down, it's continuing to be brought up. So let's get your take on it real quick. What the heck happened with Pat Kelsey yesterday, and can you confirm that this has nothing to do with Chris Mack leaving for Indiana yet and Pat Kelsey taking the Xavier job?
Yeah, it has absolutely nothing to do with that. Kels simply went Kels, and that's all that really needs to be said.
Yes. Would you agree with me that this would preclude him from being able to get the Xavier job at this point, at least right now as things stand, if Chris Mack were to, like, take the Indiana job next week?
I don't know that it would preclude it, but I think it would certainly not help his candidacy.
All right. There you go. He is the legend, Brian Snow. Appreciate you guys listening to another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast. For Dan and the legend, Brian Snow, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.